This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Slaughterhouse-Five. Written by Kurt Vonnegut. Performed by James Franco.
For Mary O'Hare and Gerhard Mueller. The cattle are lowing, the baby awakes, but the little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes. Chapter 1. All this happened, more or less. The war parts, anyway, are pretty much true. One guy I knew really was shot in Dresden for taking a teapot that wasn't his. Another guy I knew really did threaten to have his personal enemies killed by hired gunmen after the war. And so on. I've changed all the names. I really did go back to Dresden with Guggenheim money, God love it, in 1967. It looked a lot like Dayton, Ohio. More open spaces than Dayton has. There must be tons of human bone meal in the ground. I went back there with an old war buddy, Bernard V. O'Hare, and we made friends with a cab driver who took us to the slaughterhouse where we had been locked up at night as prisoners of war. His name was Gerhard Mueller. He told us that he was a prisoner of the Americans for a while. We asked him how it was to live under communism, and he said that it was terrible at first because everybody had to work so hard, and because there wasn't much shelter or food or clothing. But things were much better now. He had a pleasant little apartment, and his daughter was getting an excellent education. His mother was incinerated in the Dresden firestorm. So it goes. He sent O'Hare a postcard at Christmas time, and here's what it said. I wish you and your family also as to your friend Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and I hope that we'll meet again in the world of peace and freedom in the taxicab, if the accident will. I like that very much, if the accident will. I would hate to tell you what this lousy little book cost me in money and anxiety and time. When I got home from the Second World War 23 years ago, I thought it would be easy for me to write about the destruction of Dresden, since all I would have to do would be to report what I had seen. And I thought, too, that it would be a masterpiece, or at least make a lot of money, since the subject was so big. But not many words about Dresden came from my mind then. Not enough of them to make a book, anyway. And not many words come now, either, when I've become an old fart, with his memories and his pell-mells, with his sons full-grown. I think of how useless the Dresden part of my memory has been, and yet how tempting Dresden has been to write about. And I'm reminded of the famous limerick. There was a young man from Stamboul who soliloquized thus to his tool. You took all my wealth, and you ruined my health, and now you won't pee, you old fool. And I'm reminded, too, of the song that goes, my name is Jan Janssen, I work in Wisconsin, I work in a lumber mill there. The people I meet when I walk down the street, they say, what's your name? And I say, my name is Jan Janssen. I work in Wisconsin. And so on to infinity. Over the years, people I've met have often asked me what I'm working on. And I've usually replied that the main thing was a book about Dresden. I said that to Harrison Starr, the movie maker, one time, and he raised his eyebrows and inquired, is it an anti-war book? Yes, I said, I guess. You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books? No. What do you say, Harrison Starr? I say, why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead? What he meant, of course, was that there would always be wars, that they were as easy to stop as glaciers. I believe that, too. And even if wars didn't keep coming like glaciers, there would still be plain old death. When I was somewhat younger, working on my famous Dresden book, I asked an old war buddy named Bernard V. O'Hare if I could come to see him. He was a district attorney in Pennsylvania. I was a writer on Cape Cod. We had been privates in the war, infantry scouts. We had never expected to make any money after the war, but we were doing quite well. I had the Bell Telephone Company find him for me. They are wonderful that way. I have this disease late at night sometimes involving alcohol and the telephone. I get drunk, and I drive my wife away with a breath like mustard gas and roses. And then, speaking gravely and elegantly into the telephone, I ask the telephone operators to connect me with this friend or that one from whom I have not heard in years. I got O'Hare on the line in this way. He's short and I am tall. We were Mutt and Jeff in the war. We were captured together in the war. I told him who I was on the telephone. He had no trouble believing it. He was up. He was reading. Everybody else in his house was asleep. "Listen," I said, "I'm writing this book about Dresden. I'd like some help remembering stuff. I wonder if I could come down and see you and we could drink and talk and remember." He was unenthusiastic. He said he couldn't remember much. He told me, though, to come ahead. "I think the climax of the book will be the execution of poor old Edgar Derby," I said. "The irony is so great. A whole city gets burned down and thousands of people are killed. And then this one American foot soldier is arrested in the ruins for taking a teapot. And he's given a regular trial, and then he's shot by a firing squad." Said O'Hare. "Don't you think that's really where the climax should come?" "I don't know anything about it," he said. "That's your trade, not mine." As a trafficker in climaxes and thrills and characterization and wonderful dialogue and suspense and confrontations, I had outlined the Dresden story many times. The best outline I ever made, or anyway, the prettiest one, was on the back of a roll of wallpaper. I used my daughter's crayons, a different color for each main character. One end of the wallpaper was the beginning of the story, and the other end was the end. And then there was all that middle part, which was the middle. And the blue line met the red line, and then the yellow line, and the yellow line stopped because the character represented by the yellow line was dead, and so on. The destruction of Dresden was represented by a vertical band of orange crosshatching, and all the lines that were still alive passed through it, came out the other side. The end, where all the lines stopped, was a beet field on the Elbe, outside of Halle. The rain was coming down. The war in Europe had been over for a couple of weeks. We were formed in ranks with Russian soldiers guarding us. Englishmen, Americans, Dutchmen, Belgians, Frenchmen, Canadians, South Africans, New Zealanders, Australians. Thousands of us about to stop being prisoners of war. And on the other side of the field were thousands of Russians and Poles and Yugoslavians and so on, guarded by American soldiers. An exchange was made there in the rain, one for one. O'Hare and I climbed into the back of an American truck with a lot of others. O'Hare didn't have any souvenirs. Almost everyone else did. I had a ceremonial Luftwaffe saber. Still do. The rabid little American I call Paul Lazaro in this book had about a quart of diamonds and emeralds and rubies and so on. He had taken these from dead people in the cellars of Dresden. So it goes. An idiotic Englishman who had lost all his teeth somewhere had his souvenir in a canvas bag. The bag was resting on my insteps. He would peek into the bag every now and then, and he would roll his eyes and swivel his scrawny neck, trying to catch people looking covetously at his bag. And he would bounce the bag on my insteps. I thought this bouncing was accidental, but I was mistaken. He had to show somebody what was in the bag, and he had decided he could trust me. He caught my eye, winked, opened the bag. There was a plaster model of the Eiffel Tower in there. It was painted gold. It had a clock in it. "There's a smashing thing," he said. And we were flown to a rest camp in France, where we were fed chocolate-malted milkshakes and other rich foods until we were all covered with baby fat. Then we were sent home, and I married a pretty girl who was covered with baby fat, too. And we had babies. And they're all grown up now, and I'm an old fart with his memories and his pell-mells. My name is Jan Janssen. I work in Wisconsin. I work in a lumber mill there. Sometimes I try to call up old girlfriends on the telephone late at night, after my wife has gone to bed. "Operator, I wonder if you could give me the number of a Mrs. So-and-so. I think she lives at such-and-such." "I'm sorry, sir, there is no such listing." "Thanks, operator. Thanks just the same." And I let the dog out, or I let him in, or we talk some. I let him know I like him, and he lets me know he likes me. He doesn't mind the smell of mustard gas and roses. "You're all right, Sandy," I'll say to the dog. "You know that, Sandy? You're okay." Sometimes I'll turn on the radio and listen to a talk program from Boston or New York. I can't stand recorded music if I've been drinking a good deal. Sooner or later, I go to bed. My wife asks me what time it is. She always has to know the time. Sometimes I don't know and I say, search me. I think about my education sometimes. I went to the University of Chicago for a while after the Second World War. I was a student in the Department of Anthropology. At that time, they were teaching that there was absolutely no difference between anybody. They may be teaching that still. Another thing they taught was that nobody was ridiculous or bad or disgusting. Shortly before my father died, he said to me, "You know, you never wrote a story with a villain in it." I told him that was one of the things I learned in college after the war. While I was studying to be an anthropologist, I was also working as a police reporter for the famous Chicago City News Bureau for $28 a week. One time they switched me from the night shift to the day shift, so I worked 16 hours straight. We were supported by all the newspapers in town and the AP and the UP and all that. And we would cover the courts and the police stations and the fire department and the Coast Guard out on Lake Michigan and all that. We were connected to the institutions that supported us by means of pneumatic tubes, which ran under the streets of Chicago. Reporters would telephone in stories to writers wearing headphones, and the writers would stencil the stories on mimeograph sheets. The stories were mimeographed and stuffed into the brass and velvet cartridges, which the pneumatic tubes ate. The very toughest reporters and writers were women who had taken over the jobs of men who'd gone to war. And the first story I covered, I had to dictate over the telephone to one of those beastly girls. It was about a young veteran who had taken a job running an old-fashioned elevator in an office building. The elevator door on the first floor was ornamental iron lace. Iron ivy snaked in and out of the holes. There was an iron twig with two iron lovebirds perched upon it. This veteran decided to take his car into the basement, and he closed the door and started down. But his wedding ring was caught in all the ornaments, so he was hoisted into the air, and the floor of the car went down, dropped out from under him, and the top of the car squashed him. So it goes. So I phoned this in, and the woman who was going to cut the stencil asked me, "What did his wife say?" "She doesn't know yet," I said. "It just happened." "Call her up and get a statement." "What?" "Tell her you're Captain Finn of the police department. Say you have some sad news. Give her the news and see what she says." So I did. She said about what you would expect her to say. There was a baby and so on. When I got back to the office, the woman writer asked me, just for her own information, what the squash guy had looked like when he was squashed. I told her. "Did it bother you?" she said. She was eating a Three Musketeers candy bar. "Heck no, Nancy," I said. "I've seen lots worse than that in the war." Even then, I was supposedly writing a book about Dresden. It wasn't a famous air raid back then in America. Not many Americans knew how much worse it had been than Hiroshima, for instance. I didn't know that either. There hadn't been much publicity. I happened to tell the University of Chicago professor at a cocktail party about the raid, as I had seen it, about the book I would write. He was a member of a thing called the Committee on Social Thought, and he told me about the concentration camps and about how the Germans had made soap and candles out of the fat of dead Jews and so on. All I could say was, "I know, I know, I know." World War II had certainly made everybody very tough, and I became a public relations man for General Electric in Schenectady, New York, and a volunteer fireman in the village of Alplas, where I bought my first home. My boss there was one of the toughest guys I ever hoped to meet. He had been a lieutenant colonel in public relations in Baltimore. While I was in Schenectady, he joined the Dutch Reformed Church, which is a very tough church indeed. He used to ask me, sneeringly sometimes, why I hadn't been an officer, as though I'd done something wrong. My wife and I had lost our baby fat. Those were our scrawny years. We had a lot of scrawny veterans and their scrawny wives for friends. The nicest veterans in Schenectady, I thought, the kindest and funniest ones, the ones who hated war the most, were the ones who'd really fought. I wrote the Air Force back then, asking for details about the raid on Dresden. Who ordered it, how many planes did it, why they did it, what desirable results there had been, and so on. I was answered by a man who, like myself, was in public relations. He said that he was sorry, but that the information was top secret still. I read the letter out loud to my wife, and I said, "Secret? My God, from whom?" We were United World Federalists back then. I don't know what we are now. Telephoners, I guess. We telephone a lot, or I do, anyway, late at night. A couple of weeks after I telephoned my old war buddy, Bernard V. O'Hare, I really did go to see him. That must have been in 1964 or so, whatever the last year was for the New York World's Fair. Ehu fugaces labuntur ani. My name is Jan Janssen. There was a young man from Stamboul. I took two little girls with me, my daughter, Nanny, and her best friend, Allison Mitchell. They had never been off Cape Cod before. When we saw a river, we had to stop so they could stand by it and think about it for a while. They had never seen water in that long and narrow, unsalted form before. The river was the Hudson. There were carp in there, and we saw them. They were as big as atomic submarines. We saw waterfalls, too, streams jumping off cliffs in the valley of the Delaware. There were lots of things to stop and see. And then it was time to go. Always time to go. The little girls were wearing white party dresses and black party shoes, so strangers would know at once how nice they were. "Time to go, girls," I'd say, and we would go. And the sun went down, and we had supper in an Italian place, and then I knocked on the front door of the beautiful stone house of Bernard V. O'Hare. I was carrying a bottle of Irish whiskey like a dinner bell. I met his nice wife, Mary, to whom I dedicate this book. I dedicate it to Gerhard Mueller, the Dresden taxi driver, too. Mary O'Hare is a trained nurse, which is a lovely thing for a woman to be. Mary admired the two little girls I'd brought, mixed them in with her own children, sent them all upstairs to play games and watch television. It was only after the children were gone that I sensed that Mary didn't like me or didn't like something about the night. She was polite but chilly. "It's a nice cozy house you have here," I said, and it really was. "I have fixed up a place where you can talk and not be bothered," she said. "Good," I said, and I imagined two leather chairs near a fire in a paneled room where two old soldiers could drink and talk. But she took us into the kitchen. She had put two straight-back chairs at a kitchen table with a white porcelain top. That tabletop was screaming with reflected light from a 200-watt bulb overhead. Mary had prepared an operating room. She put only one glass on it, which was for me. She explained that O'Hare couldn't drink the hard stuff since the war. So we sat down. O'Hare was embarrassed, but he wouldn't tell me what was wrong. I couldn't imagine what it was about me that could burn up Mary so. I was a family man. I'd been married only once. I wasn't a drunk. I hadn't done her husband any dirt in the war. She fixed herself a Coca-Cola, made a lot of noise banging the ice cube tray in the stainless steel sink. Then she went to another part of the house, but she wouldn't sit still. She was moving all over the house, opening and shutting doors, even moving furniture around to work off anger. I asked O'Hare what I'd said or done to make her act that way. "It's all right," he said. "Don't worry about it. Doesn't have anything to do with you." That was kind of him. He was lying. It had everything to do with me. So we tried to ignore Mary and remember the war. I took a couple of belts of the booze I'd brought. We would chuckle or grin sometimes as though war stories were coming back, but neither one of us could remember anything good. O'Hare remembered one guy who got into a lot of wine in Dresden before it was bombed, and we had to take him home in a wheelbarrow. It wasn't much to write a book about. I remembered two Russian soldiers who had looted a clock factory. They had a horse-drawn wagon full of clocks. They were happy and drunk. They were smoking huge cigarettes they had rolled in newspaper. That was about it for memories, and Mary was still making noise. She finally came out in the kitchen again for another Coke. She took another tray of ice cubes from the refrigerator, banged it in the sink, even though there was already plenty of ice out. Then she turned to me, let me see how angry she was and that the anger was for me. She had been talking to herself, so what she said was a fragment of a much larger conversation. "You were just babies then," she said. "What?" I said. You were just babies in the war, like the ones upstairs. I nodded that this was true. We had been foolish virgins in the war, right at the end of childhood. But you're not going to write it that way, are you? This wasn't a question. It was an accusation. I don't know, I said. Well, I know, she said. You'll pretend you were men instead of babies, and you'll be played in the movies by Frank Sinatra and John Wayne or some of those other glamorous, war-loving, dirty old men, and the war will look just wonderful, so we'll have a lot more of them, and they'll be fought by babies like the babies upstairs. So then I understood. It was war that made her so angry. She didn't want her babies or anybody else's babies killed in wars. And she thought wars were partly encouraged by books and movies. So, I held up my right hand and I made her a promise. Mary, I said, I don't think this book of mine is ever going to be finished. I must have written 5,000 pages by now and thrown them all away. If I ever do finish it, though, I give you my word of honor, there won't be a part for Frank Sinatra or John Wayne. I tell you what, I said. I'll call it The Children's Crusade. She was my friend after that. O'Hare and I gave up on remembering, went into the living room, talked about other things. We became curious about the real Children's Crusade, so O'Hare looked it up in a book he had, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, by Charles Mackay, LLD. It was first published in London in 1841. Mackay had a low opinion of all crusades. The Children's Crusade, struck him, is only slightly more sordid than the 10 Crusades for grown-ups. O'Hare read this handsome passage out loud. History, in her solemn page, informs us that the Crusaders were but ignorant and savage men, that their motives were those of bigotry unmitigated, and that their pathway was one of blood and tears. Romance, on the other hand, dilates upon their piety and heroism, and portrays in her most glowing and impassioned hues their virtue and magnanimity, the imperishable honor they acquire for themselves, and the great services they rendered to Christianity. And then O'Hare read this. Now what was the grand result of all these struggles? Europe expended millions of her treasures and the blood of 2 million of her people, and a handful of quarrelsome knights retained possession of Palestine for about 100 years. Mackay told us that the Children's Crusade started in 1213, when two monks got the idea of raising armies of children in Germany and France and selling them in North Africa as slaves. 30,000 children volunteered, thinking they were going to Palestine. They were no doubt idle and deserted children who generally swarm in great cities, nurtured on vice and daring, said Mackay, and ready for anything. Pope Innocent III thought they were going to Palestine too, and he was thrilled. These children are awake while we are asleep, he said. Most of the children were shipped out of Marseille, and about half of them drowned in shipwrecks. The other half got to North Africa where they were sold. Through a misunderstanding, some children reported for duty at Genoa, where no slave ships were waiting. They were fed and sheltered and questioned kindly by good people there. They were given a little money and a lot of advice and sent back home. Hooray for the good people of Genoa, said Mary O'Hare. I slept that night in one of the children's bedrooms. O'Hare had put a book for me on the bedside table. It was Dresden, History, Stage, and Gallery by Mary Endell. It was published in 1908, and its introduction began, It is hoped that this little book will make itself useful. It attempts to give to an English reading public a bird's eye view of how Dresden came to look as it does architecturally, of how it expanded musically through the genius of a few men to its present bloom, and it calls attention to certain permanent landmarks in art that make its gallery the resort of those seeking lasting impressions. I read some history further on. Now, in 1760, Dresden underwent siege by the Prussians. On the 15th of July began the cannonade. The picture gallery took fire. Many of the paintings had been transported to the Königstein, but some were seriously injured by splinters of bombshells, notably Francia's Baptism of Christ. Furthermore, the stately Kreuzkirche Tower, from which the enemy's movements had been watched day and night, stood in flames. It later succumbed. In sturdy contrast with the pitiful fate of the Kreuzkirche stood the Frauenkirche, from the curves of whose stone dome the Prussian bombs rebounded like rain. Friedrich was obliged finally to give up the siege because he learned of the fall of Glatz, the critical point of his new conquests. "We must be off to Silesia so that we do not lose everything." The devastation of Dresden was boundless. When Goethe, as a young student, visited the city, he still found sad ruins.
"Von der Kuppel der Frauenkirche sah ich diese leidigen Trümmer wischen des schönen städtische Ordnung hineingesetzt. Da rühmte mir der Küster die Kunst des Baumeisters, welcher Kirche und Kuppel auf einen so unerwünschten Fall schon eingerichtet und bombenfest erbaut hatte. Der gute Sakristan deutete mir alsdann auf Ruinen nach allen Seiten und sagte, bedenklich lakonisch, das hat der Feind getan."
The two little girls and I crossed the Delaware River, where George Washington had crossed it, the next morning. We went to the New York World's Fair, saw what the past had been like, according to the Ford Motor Car Company and Walt Disney, saw what the future would be like, according to General Motors. And I asked myself about the present, how wide it was, how deep it was, how much was mine to keep. I taught creative writing in the famous Writer's Workshop at the University of Iowa for a couple of years after that. I got into some perfectly beautiful trouble, got out of it again. I taught in the afternoons. In the mornings I wrote. I was not to be disturbed. I was working on my famous book about Dresden. And somewhere in there, a nice man named Seymour Lawrence gave me a 3-book contract, and I said, "Okay, the first of the 3 will be my famous book about Dresden." The friends of Seymour Lawrence call him Sam, and I say to Sam now, "Sam, here's the book." It is so short and jumbled and jangled, Sam, because there is nothing intelligent to say about a massacre. Everybody's supposed to be dead, to never say anything or want anything ever again. Everything is supposed to be very quiet after a massacre, and it always is, except for the birds. And what do the birds say? All there is to say about a massacre. Things like, "Pooty wheat?" I have told my sons that they are not, under any circumstances, to take part in massacres, and that the news of massacres of enemies is not to fill them with satisfaction or glee. I have also told them not to work for companies which make massacre machinery, and to express contempt for people who think we need machinery like that. As I've said, I recently went back to Dresden with my friend O'Hare. We had a million laughs in Hamburg and West Berlin and East Berlin and Vienna and Salzburg and Helsinki and in Leningrad, too. It was very good for me because I saw a lot of authentic backgrounds for made-up stories which I will write later on. One of them will be Russian Baroque, and another will be No Kissing, and another will be Dollar Bar, and another will be If the Accident Will, and so on and so on. There was a Lufthansa plane that was supposed to fly from Philadelphia to Boston to Frankfurt. O'Hare was supposed to get on in Philadelphia, and I was supposed to get on in Boston, and off we'd go. But Boston was socked in, so the plane flew straight to Frankfurt from Philadelphia, and I became a non-person in the Boston fog, and Lufthansa put me in a limousine with some other non-persons and sent us to a motel for a non-night. The time would not pass. Somebody was playing with the clocks. Not only with the electric clocks, but with the wind-up kind, too. The second hand on my watch would twitch once, and a year would pass, and then it would twitch again. There was nothing I could do about it. As an earthling, I had to believe whatever clock said, and calendars. I had 2 books with me, which I'd meant to read on the plane. One was Words for the Wind, by Theodore Retke, and this is what I found in there. "I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I feel my fate in what I cannot fear. I learn by going where I have to go." My other book was Erika Ostrovsky's Celine and His Vision. Celine was a brave French soldier in the First World War, until his skull was cracked. After that, he couldn't sleep, and there were noises in his head. He became a doctor, and he treated poor people in the daytime, and he wrote grotesque novels at night. "No art is possible without a dance with death," he wrote. "The truth is death," he wrote. "I've fought nicely against it as long as I could, danced with it, festooned it, waltzed it around, decorated it with streamers, titillated it." Time obsessed him. Miss Ostrovsky reminded me of the amazing scene in Death on the Installment Plan, where Celine wants to stop the bustling of a street crowd. He screams on paper, "Make them stop! Don't let them move any more at all! There, make them freeze, once and for all, so that they won't disappear any more." I looked through the Gideon Bible in my motel room for tales of great destruction. "The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered into Zoar," I read. "Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground." So it goes. Those were vile people in both those cities, as is well known. The world was better off without them. And Lot's wife, of course, was told not to look back where all those people and their homes had been. But she did look back, and I love her for that, because it was so human. So she was turned to a pillar of salt. So it goes. People aren't supposed to look back. I'm certainly not going to do it anymore. I've finished my war book now. The next one I write is going to be fun. This one is a failure, and had to be, since it was written by a pillar of salt. It begins like this. "Listen, Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time." It ends like this. "Pooty wheat." Chapter 2. "Listen, Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time." Billy has gone to sleep, a senile widower, and awakened on his wedding day. He has walked through a door in 1955 and come out another one in 1941. He has gone back through that door to find himself in 1963. He has seen his birth and death many times, he says, and pays random visits to all the events in between, he says. Billy is spastic in time, has no control over where he is going next, and the trips aren't necessarily fun. He is in a constant state of stage fright, he says, because he never knows what part of his life he's going to have to act in next. Billy was born in 1922 in Ilium, New York, the only child of a barber there. He was a funny-looking child who became a funny-looking youth, tall and weak and shaped like a bottle of Coca-Cola. He graduated from Ilium High School in the upper third of his class and attended night sessions at the Ilium School of Optometry for one semester before being drafted for military service in the Second World War. His father died in a hunting accident during the war. So it goes. Billy saw service with the infantry in Europe and was taken prisoner by the Germans. After his honorable discharge from the army in 1945, Billy again enrolled in the Ilium School of Optometry. During his senior year there, he became engaged to the daughter of the founder and owner of the school and then suffered a mild nervous collapse. He was treated in a veterans hospital near Lake Placid and was given shock treatments and released. He married his fiancée, finished his education, and was set up in business in Ilium by his father-in-law. Ilium is a particularly good city for optometrists because the General Forge and Foundry Company is there. Every employee is required to own a pair of safety glasses and to wear them in areas where manufacturing is going on. GF&F has 68,000 employees in Ilium. That calls for a lot of lenses and a lot of frames. Frames are where the money is. Billy became rich. He had two children, Barbara and Robert. In time, his daughter Barbara married another optometrist, and Billy set him up in business. Billy's son Robert had a lot of trouble in high school, but then he joined the famous Green Berets. He straightened out, became a fine young man, and he fought in Vietnam. Early in 1968, a group of optometrists, with Billy among them, chartered an airplane to fly them from Ilium to an international convention of optometrists in Montreal. The plane crashed on top of Sugar Bush Mountain in Vermont. Everybody was killed but Billy. So it goes. While Billy was recuperating in a hospital in Vermont, his wife died accidentally of carbon monoxide poisoning. So it goes. When Billy finally got home to Ilium after the airplane crash, he was quiet for a while. He had a terrible scar across the top of his skull. He didn't resume practice. He had a housekeeper. His daughter came over almost every day. And then, without any warning, Billy went to New York City and got on an all-night radio program devoted to talk. He told about having come unstuck in time. He said, too, that he had been kidnapped by a flying saucer in 1967. The saucer was from the planet Tralfamador, he said. He was taken to Tralfamador, where he was displayed naked in a zoo, he said. He was mated there with a former Earthling movie star named Montana Wildhack. Some night owls in Ilium heard Billy on the radio, and one of them called Billy's daughter, Barbara. Barbara was upset. She and her husband went down to New York and brought Billy home. Billy insisted mildly that everything he had said on the radio was true. He said he had been kidnapped by the Tralfamadorians on the night of his daughter's wedding. He hadn't been missed, he said, because the Tralfamadorians had taken him through a time warp so that he could be on Tralfamador for years and still be away from Earth for only a microsecond. Another month went by without incident, and then Billy wrote a letter to the Ilium News Leader, which the paper published. It described the creatures from Tralfamador. The letter said that they were 2 feet high and green and shaped like plumber's friends. Their suction cups were on the ground, and their shafts, which were extremely flexible, usually pointed to the sky. At the top of each shaft was a little hand with a green eye in its palm. The creatures were friendly, and they could see in four dimensions. They pitied Earthlings for being able to see only three. They had many wonderful things to teach Earthlings, especially about time. Billy promised to tell what some of those wonderful things were in his next letter. Billy was working on his second letter when the first letter was published. The second letter started out like this. The most important thing I learned on Tralfamador was that when a person dies, he only appears to die. He's still very much alive in the past, so it is very silly for people to cry at his funeral. All moments, past, present, and future, always have existed, always will exist. The Tralfamadorians can look at all the different moments just the way we can look at a stretch of the Rocky Mountains, for instance. They can see how permanent all the moments are, and they can look at any moment that interests them. It is just an illusion we have here on Earth that one moment follows another one, like beads on a string, and that once a moment is gone, it is gone forever. When a Tralfamadorian sees a corpse, all he thinks is that the dead person is in a bad condition in that particular moment, but that the same person is just fine in plenty of other moments. Now, when I myself hear that somebody is dead, I simply shrug and say what the Tralfamadorians say about dead people, which is, so it goes. And so on. Billy was working on this letter in the basement rumpus room of his empty house. It was his housekeeper's day off. There was an old typewriter in the rumpus room. It was a beast. It weighed as much as a storage battery. Billy couldn't carry it very far very easily, which was why he was writing in the rumpus room instead of somewhere else. The oil burner had quit. A mouse had eaten through the insulation of a wire leading to the thermostat. The temperature in the house was down to 50 degrees, but Billy hadn't noticed. He wasn't warmly dressed either. He was barefoot and still in his pajamas and a bathrobe, though it was late afternoon. His bare feet were blue and ivory. The cockles of Billy's heart, at any rate, were glowing coals. What made them so hot was Billy's belief that he was going to comfort so many people with the truth about time. His door chimes upstairs had been ringing and ringing. It was his daughter Barbara up there wanting in. Now she let herself in with a key, crossed the floor over his head, calling, "Father? Daddy, where are you? And so on. Billy didn't answer her, so she was nearly hysterical, expecting to find his corpse. And then she looked into the very last place there was to look, which was the rumpus room. Why didn't you answer me when I called? Barbara wanted to know, standing there in the door of the rumpus room. She had the afternoon paper with her, the one in which Billy described his friends from Tralfamador. I didn't hear you, said Billy. The orchestration of the moment was this. Barbara was only 21 years old, but she thought her father was senile, even though he was only 46. Senile because of damage to his brain in the airplane crash. She also thought that she was head of the family, since she had had to manage her mother's funeral, since she had had to get a housekeeper for Billy and all that. Also, Barbara and her husband were having to look after Billy's business interests, which were considerable, since Billy didn't seem to give a damn for business anymore. All this responsibility at such an early age made her a bitchy flibbertigibbet, and Billy, meanwhile, was trying to hang on to his dignity, to persuade Barbara and everybody else that he was far from senile, that on the contrary, he was devoting himself to a calling much higher than mere business. He was doing nothing less now, he thought, than prescribing corrective lenses for earthling souls. So many of those souls were lost and wretched, Billy believed, because they could not see as well as his little green friends on Tralfamador. Don't lie to me, Father, said Barbara. I know perfectly well you heard me when I called. This was a fairly pretty girl, except that she had legs like an Edwardian grand piano. Now she raised hell with him about the letter in the paper. She said he was making a laughingstock of himself and everybody associated with him. Father, 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 said Barbara, what are we going to do with you? Are you going to force us to put you where your mother is? Billy's mother was still alive. She was in bed in an old people's home called Pine Knoll on the edge of Ilium. What is it about my letter that makes you so mad? Billy wanted to know. It's all just crazy. None of it's true. It's all true. Billy's anger was not going to rise with hers. He never got mad at anything. He was wonderful that way. There is no such planet as Tralfamador. It can't be detected from Earth, if that's what you mean, said Billy. Earth can't be detected from Tralfamador, as far as that goes. They're both very small. They're very far apart. Where did you get a crazy name like Tralfamador? That's what the creatures who live there call it. Oh, God, said Barbara, and she turned her back on him. She celebrated frustration by clapping her hands. May I ask you a simple question? Of course. Why is it you never mentioned any of this before the airplane crash? I didn't think the time was ripe. And so on. Billy says that he came unstuck in time in 1944, long before his trip to Tralfamador. The Tralfamadorians didn't have anything to do with his coming unstuck. They were simply able to give him insights into what was really going on. Billy first came unstuck while World War II was in progress. Billy was a chaplain's assistant in the war. A chaplain's assistant is customarily a figure of fun in the American Army. Billy was no exception. He was powerless to harm the enemy or to help his friends. In fact, he had no friends. He was a valet to a preacher, expected no promotions or medals, bore no arms, and had a meek faith in a loving Jesus, which most soldiers found putrid. While in maneuvers in South Carolina, Billy played hymns he knew from childhood, played them on a little black organ which was waterproof. It had 39 keys and 2 stops, Vox Humana and Vox Celeste. Billy also had charge of a portable altar, an olive drab attaché case with telescoping legs. It was lined with crimson plush, and nestled in that passionate plush were an anodized aluminum cross and a Bible. The altar and the organ were made by a vacuum cleaner company in Camden, New Jersey, and said so. One time on maneuvers, Billy was playing A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, with music by Johann Sebastian Bach and words by Martin Luther. It was Sunday morning. Billy and his chaplain had gathered a congregation of about 50 soldiers on a Carolina hillside. An umpire appeared. There were umpires everywhere. Men who said who was winning or losing the theoretical battle, who was alive and who was dead. The umpire had comical news. The congregation had been theoretically spotted from the air by a theoretical enemy. They were all theoretically dead now. The theoretical corpses laughed and ate a hearty noontime meal. Remembering this incident years later, Billy was struck by what a Tralfamadorian adventure with death that had been, to be dead and to eat at the same time. Toward the end of maneuvers, Billy was given an emergency furlough home because his father, a barber in Ilium, New York, was shot dead by a friend while they were out hunting deer. So it goes. When Billy got back from his furlough, there were orders for him to go overseas. He was needed in the headquarters company of an infantry regiment fighting in Luxembourg. The regimental chaplain's assistant had been killed in action. So it goes. When Billy joined the regiment, it was in the process of being destroyed by the Germans in the famous Battle of the Bulge. Billy never even got to meet the chaplain he was supposed to assist, was never even issued a steel helmet and combat boots. This was in December of 1944, during the last mighty German attack of the war. Billy survived, but he was a dazed wanderer far behind the new German lines. Three other wanderers, not quite so dazed, allowed Billy to tag along. Two of them were scouts, and one was an anti-tank gunner. They were without food or maps. Avoiding Germans, they were delivering themselves into rural silences ever more profound. They ate snow. They went Indian file. First came the scouts, clever, graceful, quiet. They had rifles. Next came the anti-tank gunner, clumsy and dense, warning Germans away with a Colt 45 automatic in one hand and a trench knife in the other. Last came Billy Pilgrim, empty-handed, bleakly ready for death. Billy was preposterous, 6 feet and 3 inches tall, with a chest and shoulders like a box of kitchen matches. He had no helmet, no overcoat, no weapon, and no boots. On his feet were cheap, low-cut civilian shoes which he had bought for his father's funeral. Billy had lost a heel, which made him bob up and down, up and down. The involuntary dancing up and down made his hip joints sore. Billy was wearing a thin field jacket, a shirt and trousers of scratchy wool, and long underwear that was soaked with sweat. He was the only one of the four who had a beard. It was a random, bristly beard, and some of the bristles were white, even though Billy was only 21 years old. He was also going bald. Wind and cold and violent exercise had turned his face crimson. He didn't look like a soldier at all. He looked like a filthy flamingo. And on the third day of wandering, somebody shot at the four from far away, shot 4 times as they crossed a narrow brick road. One shot was for the scouts. The next one was for the anti-tank gunner, whose name was Roland Weary. The third bullet was for the filthy flamingo, who stopped dead in the center of the road when the lethal bee buzzed past his ear. Billy stood there politely, giving the marksman another chance. It was his addled understanding of the rules of warfare that the marksman should be given a second chance. The next shot missed Billy's kneecaps by inches, going end on end from the sound of it. Roland Weary and the scouts were safe in a ditch, and Weary growled at Billy, "Get out of the road, you dumb motherfucker!" The last word was still a novelty in the speech of white people in 1944. It was fresh and astonishing to Billy, who had never fucked anybody. And it did its job. It woke him up and got him off the road. "Saved your life again, you dumb bastard," Weary said to Billy in the ditch. He had been saving Billy's life for days, cursing him, kicking him, slapping him, making him move. It was absolutely necessary that cruelty be used because Billy wouldn't do anything to save himself. Billy wanted to quit. He was cold, hungry, embarrassed, incompetent. He could scarcely distinguish between sleep and wakefulness now, on the third day, found no important differences either between walking and standing still. He wished everybody would leave him alone. "You guys go on without me," he said, again and again. Weary was as new to war as Billy. He was a replacement, too. As a part of a gun crew, he had helped to fire one shot in anger from a 57-millimeter anti-tank gun. The gun made a ripping sound, like the opening of the zipper on the fly of God Almighty. The gun lapped up snow and vegetation with a blowtorch 30 feet long. The flame left a black arrow on the ground, showing the Germans exactly where the gun was hidden. The shot was a miss. What had been missed was a Tiger tank. It swiveled its 88mm snout around sniffingly, saw the arrow on the ground. It fired. It killed everybody on the gun crew but Weary. So it goes. Roland Weary was only 18, was at the end of an unhappy childhood spent mostly in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He had been unpopular in Pittsburgh. He had been unpopular because he was stupid and fat and mean and smelled like bacon no matter how much he washed. He was always being ditched in Pittsburgh by people who did not want him with them. It made Weary sick to be ditched. When Weary was ditched, he would find somebody who was even more unpopular than himself, and he would horse around with that person for a while, pretending to be friendly. And then he would find some pretext for beating the shit out of him. It was a pattern. It was a crazy, sexy, murderous relationship Weary entered into with people he eventually beat up. He told them about his father's collection of guns and swords and torture instruments and leg irons and so on. Weary's father, who was a plumber, actually did collect such things, and his collection was insured for $4,000. He wasn't alone. He belonged to a big club composed of people who collected things like that. Weary's father once gave Weary's mother a Spanish thumbscrew in working condition for a kitchen paperweight. Another time he gave her a table lamp whose base was a model 1 foot high of the famous Iron Maiden of Nuremberg. The real Iron Maiden was a medieval torture instrument, a sort of boiler which was shaped like a woman on the outside and lined with spikes. The front of the woman was composed of two hinged doors. The idea was to put a criminal inside and then close the doors slowly. There were two special spikes where his eyes would be. There was a drain in the bottom to let out all the blood. So it goes. Weary had told Billy Pilgrim about the Iron Maiden, about the drain in her bottom, and what that was for. He had talked to Billy about dum-dums. He told him about his father's Derringer pistol, which could be carried in a vest pocket, which was yet capable of making a hole in a man, which a bull bat could fly through without touching either wing. Weary scornfully bet Billy one time that he didn't even know what a blood gutter was. Billy guessed that it was the drain in the bottom of the Iron Maiden, but that was wrong. A blood gutter, Billy learned, was the shallow groove in the side of the blade of a sword or bayonet. Weary told Billy about neat tortures he'd read about or seen in the movies or heard on the radio, about other neat tortures he himself had invented. One of the inventions was sticking a dentist's drill into a guy's ear. He asked Billy what he thought the worst form of execution was. Billy had no opinion. The correct answer turned out to be this. You stake a guy out on an anthill in the desert, see? He's facing upwards, and you put honey all over his balls and pecker, and you cut off his eyelids so he has to stare at the sun till he dies. So it goes. Now, lying in the ditch with Billy and the scouts after having been shot at, Weary made Billy take a very close look at his trench knife. It wasn't government issue. It was a present from his father. It had a 10-inch blade that was triangular in cross-section. Its grip consisted of brass knuckles, was a chain of rings through which Weary slipped his stubby fingers. The rings weren't simple. They bristled with spikes. Weary laid the spikes along Billy's cheek, roweled the cheek with savagely affectionate restraint. How'd you like to be hit with this, He wanted to know. I wouldn't, said Billy. Know why the blade's triangular? No. Makes a wound that won't close up. Oh. Makes a three-sided hole in a guy. You stick an ordinary knife in a guy, makes a slit, right? A slit closes right up, right? Right. Shit, what do you know? What the hell they teach in college?
I wasn't there very long, said Billy, which was true. He had had only 6 months of college, and the college hadn't been a regular college either. It had been the night school of the Ilium School of Optometry.
Joe College, said Weary scathingly. Billy shrugged. There's more to life than what you read in books, said Weary. You'll find that out. Billy made no reply to this either, there in the ditch, since he didn't want the conversation to go on any longer than necessary. He was dimly tempted to say, though, that he knew a thing or two about gore. Billy, after all, had contemplated torture and hideous wounds at the beginning and the end of nearly every day of his childhood. Billy had an extremely gruesome crucifix hanging on the wall of his little bedroom in Ilium. A military surgeon would have admired the clinical fidelity of the artist's rendition of all Christ's wounds. The spear wound, the thorn wound, the holes that were made by the iron spikes. Billy's Christ died horribly. He was pitiful. So it goes. Billy wasn't a Catholic, even though he grew up with a ghastly crucifix on the wall. His father had no religion. His mother was a substitute organist for several churches around town. She took Billy with her whenever she played, taught him to play a little too. She said she was going to join a church as soon as she decided which one was right. She never did decide. She did develop a terrific hankering for a crucifix, though, and she bought one from a Santa Fe gift shop during a trip the little family made out west during the Great Depression. Like so many Americans, she was trying to construct a life that made sense from things she found in gift shops. And the crucifix went up on the wall of Billy Pilgrim. The two scouts, loving the walnut stalks of their rifles in the ditch, whispered that it was time to move out again. 10 minutes had gone by without anybody's coming to see if they were hit or not, to finish them off. Whoever had shot was evidently far away and all alone. And the four crawled out of the ditch without drawing any more fire. They crawled into a forest, like the big, unlucky mammals they were. Then they stood up and began to walk quickly. The forest was dark and old. The pines were planted in ranks and files. There was no undergrowth. 4 inches of unmarked snow blanketed the ground. The Americans had no choice but to leave trails in the snow as unambiguous as diagrams in a book on ballroom dancing. Step, slide, rest. Step, slide, rest.
"Close it up and keep it closed," Roland Weary warned Billy Pilgrim as they moved out.
Weary looked like Tweedledum or Tweedledee, all bundled up for battle. He was short and thick. He had every piece of equipment he had ever been issued, every present he'd received from home, helmet, helmet liner, wool cap, scarf, gloves, cotton undershirt, woolen undershirt, wool shirt, sweater, blouse, jacket, overcoat, cotton underpants, woolen underpants, woolen trousers, cotton socks, woolen socks, combat boots, gas mask, canteen, mess kit, first aid kit, trench knife, blanket, shelter half, raincoat, bulletproof Bible, a pamphlet entitled Know Your Enemy, another pamphlet entitled Why We Fight, and another pamphlet of German phrases rendered in English phonetics, which would enable Weary to ask Germans questions such as, "Where is your headquarters?" and "How many howitzers have you?" or to tell them, "Surrender, your situation is hopeless," and so on. Weary had a box of balsa wood, which was supposed to be a foxhole pillow. He had a prophylactic kit containing 2 tough condoms for the prevention of disease only. He had a whistle he wasn't going to show anybody until he got promoted to corporal. He had a dirty picture of a woman attempting sexual intercourse with a Shetland pony. He had made Billy Pilgrim admire that picture several times. The woman and the Shetland pony were posed before velvet draperies, which were fringed with deedly balls. They were flanked by Doric columns. In front of one column was a potted palm. The picture that Weary had was a print of the first dirty photograph in history. The word photography was first used in 1839, and it was in that year, too, that Louis J.M. Daguerre revealed to the French Academy that an image formed on a silvered metal plate covered with a thin film of silver iodide could be developed in the presence of mercury vapor. In 1841, only 2 years later, an assistant to Daguerre, André Lefebvre, was arrested in the Tuileries Gardens for attempting to sell a gentleman a picture of the woman and the pony. That was where Weary bought his picture, too, in the Tuileries. Lefebvre argued that the picture was fine art and that his intention was to make Greek mythology come alive. He said the columns in the potted palm proved that. When asked which myth he meant to represent, Lefebvre replied that there were thousands of myths like that, with the woman a mortal and the pony a god. He was sentenced to 6 months in prison. He died there of pneumonia. So it goes. Billy and the scouts were skinny people. Roland Weary had fat to burn. He was a roaring furnace under all his layers of wool and straps and canvas. He had so much energy that he bustled back and forth between Billy and the scouts, delivering dumb messages which nobody had sent and which nobody was pleased to receive. He also began to suspect, since he was so much busier than anybody else, that he was the leader. He was so hot and bundled up, in fact, that he had no sense of danger. His vision of the outside world was limited to what he could see through a narrow slit between the rim of his helmet and his scarf from home, which concealed his baby face from the bridge of his nose on down. He was so snug in there that he was able to pretend that he was safe at home, having survived the war, and that he was telling his parents and his sister a true war story, whereas the true war story was still going on. Weary's version of the true war story went like this. There was a big German attack, and Weary and his anti-tank buddies fought like hell until everybody was killed but Weary. So it goes. And then Weary tied in with two scouts, and they became close friends immediately, and they decided to fight their way back to their own lines. They were going to travel fast. They were damned if they'd surrender. They shook hands all around. They called themselves the Three Musketeers. But then this damn college kid, who was so weak he shouldn't even have been in the army, asked if he could come along. He didn't even have a gun or a knife. He didn't even have a helmet or a cap. He couldn't even walk right. Kept bobbing up and down, driving everybody crazy, giving their position away. He was pitiful. The Three Musketeers pushed and carried and dragged the college kid all the way back to their own lines, Weary's story went. They saved his goddamn hide for him. In real life, Weary was retracing his steps, trying to find out what had happened to Billy. He had told the scouts to wait while he went back for the college bastard. He passed under a low branch now. It hit the top of his helmet with a clonk. Weary didn't hear it. Somewhere, a big dog was barking. Weary didn't hear that either. His war story was at a very